a woman in Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yes and no. I mean, obviously, she was a pivotal part in the entire conspiracy that was going on. You know, a lot of my clients would have never gotten caught up in the Epstein debacle had it not been for a woman that recruited them. And that's the reality of this. You know, if a 50, 55-year-old man approaches a young girl on the street, the young girl's going to thankfully run. There's an instinct there that this is wrong. There's something inappropriate. But if a beautiful woman approaches you with a nice English accent and talks about how she can make you a star or make you famous or modeling or wherever, you know, a lot of these young girls' guards were caught down. So I always say that without Maxwell, there would have been no Epstein.
Spencer Cuven, lawyer who represents the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. Thank you very much for talking to us today. Well, that's all from me, but it's been a busy program and a busy day. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was the technical operator. Up next, and here with me now, Fee Glover and Jane Garvey. What have you got?
Well, there is that announcement. Well, I say announcement.
I know.
A press conference. The leader of Scottish Labour is making an unexpected appearance at a press conference. What could it all be about, Jo?
Well, I think we're about to find out.
Yeah.
Have a great programme.
Stay tuned.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio. The voice of the times.
Welcome. It is 2 o'clock. It's Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until four.
And in the next 2 hours, we are on calling for the PM resignation watch. More from Anna Sawa as we get it. We'll check in with Roy Nika, who is in Saudi Arabia with the Prince of Wales, who today has put out that statement in support of Jeffrey Epstein's victims. Was the Super Bowl halftime show a joyful celebration of America, or as Donald Trump called it, a slap in the face? We'll assess Bad Bunny's performance last night. We've got our literary Salon with Laura Hackett and Adam Shaw on Assets with Attitude. We don't know what that is either, but we're going to find out together.
I think apparently it's investing in handbags, so it's not quite as exciting as you might think. I've undersold it now, haven't I? Here's the news at two. Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Times understands that Scottish Labour leader Anna Sawa will this afternoon call on the Prime Minister to quit. He's expected to speak about the chaos in Downing Street that has seen two senior advisers depart in 24 hours. But a spokesman for Sir Keir Starmer insists he's not resigning and will be concentrating on the job in hand. It comes as Number 10 has... One of the MPs, who will be addressed by Starmer this evening at a key meeting of MPs, Cal Turner, told Times Radio the Prime Minister needs time to recover from mistakes.
The electorate think we're absolutely stark, raving, barmy when we're doing what the Tories did not so many years ago, getting rid of leaders every time things are a bit tough. So my view and my advice to people is calm it down. We have a mandate. We've got a majority in Parliament, about 169. What on earth are people doing?
Police are looking into claims that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor exploited his work as trade envoy for the government by passing information to Jeffrey Epstein. Thames Valley Police say they're assessing information that appears to show he shared confidential files in emails released by the US Department of Justice. Meanwhile, the King has again been heckled over Andrew's links to Epstein as the Prince and Princess of Wales make their first public statement on the issue. William and Kate are said to be deeply concerned. The former prince's biographer, Andrew Lowney, thinks the Kensington and Buckingham Palace state will need to say more.
I think what they need to be open about is actually what the palace knew and when they knew it and what they've done. Because I think what we do need to do is to find out exactly how Andrew has been protected and I think continues to be protected. I don't think we've got the full story of what happened and the flight from Royal Lodge and all that.
A nursery worker has been found guilty of 8 sexual offences against children. 30-year-old Nathan Bennett previously pleaded guilty to 13 other charges relating to the same nursery in Bristol. The jury heard the offences involved 5 children aged 2 or 3. A teaching union is calling on the government to introduce legislation to ban mobile phones in schools. The NASUWT says non-statutory guidance on bans from the Department for Education exposes schools to challenges and creates uncertainty. The General Secretary of the union says guidance and supportive words are not enough to deal with what he calls the most damaging source of disruption in classrooms. The son of a pro-democracy campaigner who's been jailed for 20 years in Hong Kong fears his father will die behind bars. 78-year-old British citizen Jimmy Lai says charges against him are politically motivated. Donald Trump has called the Super Bowl halftime show an affront to the greatness of America. Bad Bunny celebrated his Puerto Rican heritage and carried a message of togetherness last night. In sport, heartbreak at the Winter Olympics for Team GB's Kirsty Muir as she finished fourth in the women's freeski slopestyle final. She fell narrowly short of Canada's Megan Oldham and the bronze medal. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
4 minutes past two. We're days away from Proud as a Peacock Thursday, but we'll get there with your help. Welcome to the programme. So much to talk about today. The leader of the Scottish Labour Party is set to call on the Prime Minister to resign. You'll hear that on Times Radio in the next hour. President Trump is not a fan of Big Bunny Shock. He also objected to the dancers at the Super Bowl last night. This is President Trump. He thought their twerking might upset American children. Well, they've had Donald Trump in their lives for quite a while and they seem to be managing, so who knows. Vassos Alexander will be here at 3:15 with the big sports stories of the day, news from the slopes at the Winter Olympics, and just what on earth was going on at Anfield last night with the VAR. I mean, that's the big talking point of the day, really, isn't it?
Vassos Alexander is going to come in to talk about that.
Yeah. He also talked at some length last week and really got me involved in the whole Lindsay Vonn saga, and so I made a point of watching her on Sunday morning, and honestly, as a viewer, it was grim.
It was heartbreaking,
really, really tough. And I think there was a couple of moments when we weren't really sure how she was,
and then the scenes of her being airlifted. So for people who didn't watch it and aren't interested in winter sport, she was skiing only days after having surgery on
ruptured ACL.
Yeah. She's 41 years old. An awful lot of people, and we talked about this with Vassos last week, didn't we, thought that actually at some point authorities should intervene and say, we're not sure, you know, that this is a very good idea. That is a punishing downhill run. And she crashed, went straight onto her knees. She had to be airlifted off the mountain. There was a scene of the helicopter taking her and the paramedic who was with her. You know, they stay on the bottom of the rope, don't they, as they're being taken off the mountain because the helicopter can't land. I mean, in scenes where you just think, OMG, this is sport. It's meant to be fun.
Didn't look like fun.
No.
She was brave. Maybe she was foolish, but that's what makes great sports people. They're not like the rest of us, are they? Laura Hackett is in our literary salon at about 3:30. We're going to celebrate apparently what is regarded as an absolutely remarkable debut novel by a poet. It's called May We Feed the King. And there'll be a retrospective look at James Joyce's The Dubliners.
Have you read that? You did English for your degree.
Do you know what? I think I have read The Dubliners. That's the James Joyce novel I was able to finish. Actually, isn't that a series of short stories? She said nervously. Anyway, Laura Hackett with us at 3:30. And Adam Shaw has your personal finance news at about 3:45. Today, we're talking quirky investments, basically ditch stocks and shares. Go for handbags and some decent whiskey. That's with Adam before 4:00. I think there'll be plenty of people in Britain's politics who may be reaching for a bottle of whiskey before close of play today. What are the most read stories on the Times website?
In at number three, Epstein's British girlfriend told him to recruit descendants of slaves. Messages released by US authorities show Shelley Lewis discussing their relationship, finances, and even having a child with the disgraced billionaire. The second most read story, police examine claims Andrew exploited trade role by passing reports to Epstein. Andrew has been accused of ruthlessly exploiting his role as a government trade envoy. We're going to talk about that in a couple of moments' time. The most read piece on the Times website, number 10 director of comms resigns as Keir Starmer fights for survival. That is the Times' live page. It's very busy. Blink and you'll miss the latest update on all the chaos inside Downing Street. That particular story is about the communications director, Tim Allen, who's resigned earlier today, less than 24 hours after Starmer's chief of staff quit. At this rate,
rate they're going to do something to the employment unemployment figures, aren't they? Such as the busyness of the opening and closing door at number 10 Downing Street.
We can't be certain we'll be here at 4 o'clock, so we may have been called into Downing Street to do a shift. So brace yourselves. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp that takes you through to the Times Radio studio.
As Jane said, we will be taking any press conference by the Scottish Labour leader live. We will bring you news just as we get it on that. We're going to turn our attention to the other big story of the day, though. Police are looking into allegations that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor forwarded official documents to Jeffrey Epstein. Thames Valley Police say they're assessing information released by the US Department of Justice. Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing. Now, this comes after the Prince and Princess of Wales said they were deeply concerned by the latest revelations about Epstein. The statement was made today while Prince William is on an official visit to Saudi Arabia. Well, the Sunday Times royal editor Ryan Nika is covering that trip and joins us now. A very good afternoon from us in London, Roya. Just remind people or tell people who are just joining us what the statement actually says.
So the statement that we had from the spokesman this morning in Riyadh said that the Prince and Princess of Wales have been deeply concerned by the revelations that have been coming out and that their sympathies remain with the victims. Now, the interesting thing about this statement is it's the first time we've heard directly from William and Catherine, because back in October, when the King finally stripped Andrew of all his remaining titles, we just heard a sort of indirect background comment from the spokesman that they supported the King's leadership. It's the first time they've come out and actually said they're very concerned and made a statement of their own. And of course, as you mentioned, I mean, I'm in Riyadh waiting for William's arrival at the Royal Terminal here. Very high level visit this with the Saudis and with MBS. And all of this is overshadowing this on the very first day.
Yeah. This is the first statement, as you've said. I mean, it's pretty clear who and what it is condemning. But would it simply have gone too far, Roya, for Andrew to ever be named by a member of his own family in those condemnations?
I think the Prince and Princess think that the British public and the wider public are smart enough to know who they are referring to. And I don't think they see it as a damning. I mean, they've got to be slightly careful in their language. But I think the very fact that we've had an on-the-record statement from the palace directly from them shows the seriousness with which they're sort of taking this. There, I've seen, you know, there are suggestions this is perhaps a little bit too late and should have come sooner. It's always one of those things with the palace where the cogs move slowly and they wait to see what the top house does. But I think given what they've seen over the past week, it's fair to say everyone in all the households is pretty appalled by what's coming out.
So obviously more news today, courtesy of the release of information by the US Department of Justice that has directly led to Thames Valley Police assessing that information. It's a police matter. We'll be slightly careful about what we say, but the claims of documents being forwarded, I mean, we have been discussing what's in them for a while now, haven't we?
We have. And I think, you know, this is, again, being out here on this kind of visit, it's pretty extraordinary to think that when the former Prince Andrew was on official visits on behalf of the government, the claims are what appears to be in these files show, and this is what Republic have complained to Thames Valley Police about, there is a suggestion that he had actually shared sensitive information and conversations that he'd had with various, you know, world leaders, high level government officials. The idea that just the idea that a member of the royal family would do that is extraordinary. I know we're all still reeling from knowing that what has come out in the files suggesting that Peter Mandelson has done that. But the fact that, you know, it is suggested that the late Queen's son on official business was forwarding that to Epstein is a pretty extraordinary allegation.
It is. You've made some interesting points, Roya, in the pieces you've written recently about the damage that all of this has done to the whole family's reputation. And actually, a lot of people around Andrew might need to be looked at with a more scrupulous eye with the information that we now have. And, you know, he was appointed trade envoy to give him something to do, wasn't he, when he left the forces. The Queen was involved in that appointment, wasn't she?
Tony Blair was heavily involved in that appointment. You know, that was a government appointment. The Queen, you know, as much as people respected her, was not able to just parachute members of her family into official trade roles. And I think there will be a lot of questions, a lot more investigation and digging around his time in that role, which was 10 years. But a lot of questions about the sense of, and what questions were asked in government and various, you know, we're seeing all of this now. Who knew what? Did the government really, it's extraordinary when you think now in hindsight that the government thought that Andrew was the right person to do that job for 10 years.
Yeah. And you know, he made numerous, what were kind of dismissed as bloops and blunders along the way. But some of them involved, you know, rather, I'm just going to say it, Roy, shady people.
You can say it. And it's, you know, we have all said that for a long time. Even before all of this came out, there were always so many question marks over the characters that Andrew seemed to be sort of nurturing, you know, the Gaddafis, all of that. Why was he doing that? Was that just in our national interest, or was there something else to it? Those questions continue. You know, the volume is being turned up on those questions in the last few weeks. But I think there is still a lot more, I suspect, that may come out around that role. And it's certainly something that a lot of my colleagues are looking at.
Does Andrew grasp the situation he's created?
The answer to that, I think, Fee, is no, which is why we had such extraordinary scenes last week of the King accelerating, as I was told, that move from Windsor, which wasn't supposed to happen until Easter, up to Norfolk. Because the very fact of what we saw, the awful things we saw come out the Epstein files 10 days ago, all these new claims against Andrew, you would have thought he might just keep a low profile, keep his head down. That's what the royal family hoped. But no, out he went riding around Windsor Great Park, past the camera crews, knowing where they were. And, you know, I think that just goes to show I don't think he still quite grasps the damage that has been done and the level of just fury. And actually, I think widespread, if I'm going to say it, revulsion about some of the claims we are seeing.
Yeah, but he seems to be the only person in the country who can't see it, Roy. Let's turn to William's visit to Saudi Arabia, something that he has been asked officially to do by the government. What is he meant to be achieving whilst he and Catherine are there?
Well, it's just him, actually. Catherine's not coming. It's just William coming. We had a really interesting briefing this morning with his aides and with the ambassador out here in Saudi about the objectives of this visit. And it's interesting, sort of crown prince to crown prince. Of course, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, is the de facto leader out here. There is a king, but he runs the show. He's prime minister. And I think there is a really strong desire to boost the relationship between the UK and Saudi, but actually really build the relationship between the two quote-unquote crown princes. Long live the king, but of course the king here has not been in good health. King Charles has not been in good health. It may be in the coming years that, you know, William and MBS are both kings for a very long time together, and the UK government and the Saudi see it as absolutely critical to our diplomatic relations and our trade relations that they boost that relationship now.
What would success look like, though, from it? Or is it just never possible to quantify that?
Oh, I think you probably could. I mean, there's a, you know, free trade deal that's on the cards between the UK and the Gulf states, Saudi, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, that the government feel is 97% there. I think they'd like to get that over the line. But what we are hearing here is that they are absolutely delighted that William is visiting, because the engagements that they're doing show off sort of this vision to 2030, a lot of the environmental work that the Saudis have been doing. But I think at the heart of this visit, as we approach sort of 100 years of diplomacy with Saudi next year, is trade and investment.
Yeah. I mean, it is another country, Roy, that not everybody is at ease with. And
as I wrote last week, you cannot escape. And William is very alive to the fact he is meeting, we're having dinner tonight with a very divisive leader. But I think the government recognise William's quite good with divisive leaders. They quite like him. Donald Trump, you know, he's a big fan. And so the UK government will use William when they can. And William acknowledges that's just part of the job, whether he kind of likes it or not.
Yeah. You'd just so want to be a fly on a wall when the official duties ended, wouldn't you? Just to hear the exhalation of breath or whatever it would be. Roy, it is always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. You can always read Roy's pieces in the Sunday Times. And obviously, you can read other coverage across the week too. There will be more on William's visit in Saudi Arabia.
Yes, which I'm sure William hopes won't be overshadowed by other things. But worth saying that, again, the King has been out and about today in Clitheroe in Lancashire, heckled again by somebody in the crowd saying, "How long have you known about Andrew?" It's just not going away, is it?
No, it won't.
No, and it shouldn't really, should it? Coming up, you're with Times Radio. Why did Donald Trump declare last night's Super Bowl halftime performance one of the worst ever? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix at 18 minutes past two. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or go to your local Wix store.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight. No fake news, no flag waving, and no Trump derangement syndrome.
Fascinating week in Trumpland, MAGA-land, what used to be called the United States of America.
Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Ever wondered if travelling solo could be the perfect way to meet other like-minded travellers? Or dreamed of exploring new countries in small groups led by the best local guides? Ever wondered what it feels like to sail on a ship dedicated exclusively to solo travellers? Or to travel the world knowing every detail has been expertly taken care of? Spend less and experience more with 10% off all Riviera Travel solo holidays in 2026. It's a wonder why you'd choose anyone else. Book today with Riviera Travel. Habitat and Atoll protected.
Spire Healthcare gave me my life back.
The care I received was incredible.
Every year, over a million patients trust Spire Healthcare. See a leading medical expert privately in as little as 48 hours and get back to what you love sooner.
Spire Healthcare have given me a whole new lease of life.
And now I feel unbreakable again.
The sooner you're better, the better. Search Spire Healthcare today.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wix.co.uk.
You're with Times Radio. You're very welcome. 20 past two. Just a warning that at around 2:30, we're going to go to Scotland to hear the leader of Scottish Labour, Anas Sarwar. He has arranged a press conference, hasn't he?
I like the fact you've given a warning.
Well, I think people need to know. They need to mark their car. Don't head off to the kettle.
We'll be hearing from Scotland.
Scotland calling. It's like the Eurovision Song Contest, only with rather more jeopardy for our current Prime Minister. Yeah, don't be tucking into something in the biscuit barrel at 2:30 because you'll want to be with us on Times Radio, focusing on what the Scottish Labour leader has to say. It is being widely reported that he's going to call on Sir Keir Starmer to quit. Right, the only thing more powerful than hate is love. That was the message behind Bad Bunny as he headlined this year's Super Bowl halftime show. It's a traditional 14-minute spectacle that doubled as a kind of love letter to his home country of Puerto Rico and a call for unity across the Americas. Now, the set made history as the first show to be delivered almost entirely in Spanish. There were guest performances from Lady Gaga and Ricky Martin.
Ey, Titi me preguntó si tengo muchas novias. Ey, muchas novias. Hoy tengo a una, mañana a otra. Pero no hay boda. Titi me preguntó si tengo muchas novias. Ey, muchas novias. Hoy tengo a una, mañana a otra. Ey, me la voy a llevar a todas pa' un VIP. Ey, saludan a Titi, vamos a tirar un selfie.
I'm gonna hold you just for a while.
Venezuela, Guyana, Panamá, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala.
Puerto Rico.
Oh, the energy. You heard Ricky Martin, a bit of Gaga as well in there, and of course Bad Bunny in charge. Now, President Trump has since posted on Truth Social that the performance was terrible, absolutely terrible, he called it, and a slap in the face. Well, Xing Zhang is a journalist and author of Forgotten Women, joins us now. It's no surprise that Donald Trump didn't care for this, but the rest of the world seems to have loved it, Xing.
Yes, I mean, the reaction from the world about the Super Bowl performance has been, you know, just an outpouring of joy and love, which I think is exactly what Bad Bunny intended for this performance to communicate. You know, that catchphrase, the only thing more powerful than hate is love, is one that he said just a few weeks ago when he picked up Album of the Year at the Grammys. And it's certainly something that I think has been on his mind, given the division and violence in the United States at this time.
And during this performance, he didn't make any overtly political remarks, did he?
No, and I think that really did subvert expectations, because I think everyone thought that this would be a very political show that explicitly calls out ICE raids and also Donald Trump, as he did in his Grammy speech. But I think instead he chose to very wisely and presciently focus on the fact that, you know, Latin American culture is incredibly vibrant, particularly Puerto Rican culture, and that it has a place within America, just as every other kind of, you know, immigrant community does in the United States. So I think that, you know, it was a really powerful political statement, because he didn't explicitly call out the very names and the people that most people thought he would.
And it was almost entirely in Spanish. For people who aren't familiar with Bad Bunny, does he perform it entirely in Spanish? Is that simply what he does?
Yes, he does. And in fact, his album that he won the Grammy for, Debut Tira Ma Foto, is essentially performed entirely in Spanish. I think the only thing he actually said in English throughout most of the entire set was God Bless America, which I think is also a very powerful statement. And yes, you know, he's been very adamant that Spanish is his language as a Puerto Rican, even though Puerto Rico is an American territory. And he is very, very much focused on bringing and showcasing Puerto Rican culture to the wider world. And part of that means singing in his language.
Now, this guy is no, well, I mean, he's not a flash in the pan, is he? He's the world's most played artist last year. So I imagine that the organisers of the Super Bowl know a good booking when they see one.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Donald Trump and various MAGA figures have said that this is the Super Bowl bowing to woke culture and etc. But really, if you look at the numbers, Bad Bunny is bigger than Taylor Swift. His songs have been streamed almost 20 billion times. That puts him ahead of Taylor. And he really is the king of a new kind of emerging genre of pop music, which is called música urbana, so urban music. It's this kind of catch-all global blend of modern Spanish language music, you know, influences from all over the world, dembow, salsa, reggaeton, Latin pop. So really he is, you know, a musician who is kind of championing these sounds to an incredibly big audience.
Donald Trump wouldn't have liked it much if it had been Taylor, actually, would he? Because he's not a big fan of her either.
No, he doesn't like very much these days.
No, that's true. It's his age, I think, actually. He is nearly 80. It's that fact, I guess, that Latin America is just having such an making such an impression, having such an impact on what you might call mainstream American entertainment. Some people lap it up and absolutely love it, regardless of their heritage, and others are just incredibly wary. Do you see that situation changing?
I do think so, because I think that pop culture has enormous influence over attitudes towards immigrants. You know, we see that with other genres like rap and hip hop. I think that, you know, the more culture becomes popular, the more this kind of Latin American culture becomes more globally popular, the more that we'll see influences bleed into other kinds of genres, as we already have done. And we also see a kind of cross-pollination between not just Latin pop, but also other more traditional genres of music. So, for instance, the Spanish artist Rosalía has been really critically praised for an album that came out towards the end of last year that fuses, you know, everything from Latin pop to opera and classical music. So it's that kind of cultural cross-pollination, I think, that is really kind of powerful. And I also think stands in really sharp contrast to the kind of division currently going on in the United States.
Did Bad Bunny do this gig as a kind of strategic move? Or is it regarded as an honour?
it is very much regarded as a huge honor to headline the Super Bowl halftime show. And, you know, you've seen huge artists like Beyonce use it as a platform to talk about their political views as well. So I think that for Bad Bunny, it makes both political sense, but also cultural sense. You know, this is widely regarded as, I guess, the closest equivalent they have to the Glastonbury headline set in America. So, of course, he would want to be on that stage. He would want to platform his music. And I think what's, you know, really lovely about the choices he's made artistically during that show is that even though it's star-studded, even though there's people like Lady Gaga and Ricky Martin making a cameo, there are also really sweet call-outs and nods to Puerto Rican culture. You know, there's a scene in the show where he accepts a little shot from an old lady behind a bar, and her name is actually Tonita, and she runs one of the biggest social clubs for Puerto Ricans in New York. You know, that's that kind of specific detail that I think really speaks to his love of Latin American culture.
Yeah, no, that I thought there were some really lovely, very personal touches. Clearly an enormous amount of thought had gone into this. It was going to rile Donald Trump. It has riled him. I guess everybody's happy. I've still got no idea who won the actual match. Does anybody care about that?
Not me, but, you know, I'm not an American football fan.
No, nor am I. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. We really appreciate it. That's Xing Zeng, journalist and author of a really interesting book called Forgotten Women. The game was, I think, won by the... Was it the New England Patriots came second? They lost. But for the life of me, I can't remember who won. Can you?
I take no interest in American football at all. I'm a big fan of Bad Bunny now.
Oh, yeah.
And I will listen to nothing else but Bad Bunny. But yeah, I'm afraid the sport has always passed me by.
Yeah, no, it's passed me by too.
But it's an interesting one about the dancing, isn't it? Because the Super Bowl has got into trouble before for wardrobe malfunctions.
Oh yeah, there was an exposed...
That was, you know, quite a sensation.
Yeah.
But quite frequently, some hefty gyration will be on show, but it's there everywhere, Donald.
Hefty gyration?
Yes, that's a technical term for it.
Okay, and it so disturbed Donald Trump.
Do you think?
Well, he was really upset by it, and he was worried about the children of America who may have been exposed to some gyrations that they were previously entirely unaware of. It was the Seahawks that won. Thank you, Sherry. Was it? I don't know. Seattle Seahawks. Thank you very much. Well, good for them.
Yeah. Susie says, don't be so ageist.
No,
Bad Bunny, saying that Trump doesn't like this sort of music. Well, it's his age.
Right, well,
that's awful.
Well, yeah, I take it back. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes, it's a very sincere apology. I enjoyed it
enormously. Early in the week. If you want a sincere apology, tune in on Thursday.
Right, we are 0333 003 2353. We're Jane and Fee at times.radio. Anything that we're talking about, we love it if you join in. Always happy to hear from you. Anna Sawa is going to speak. We will hear what the Scottish Labour leader has to say in a couple of moments' time, I think. So let's get the latest news headlines with Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The Times understands that Scottish Labour leader Anna Sawa will shortly call on the Prime Minister to quit. He's expected to speak about the chaos in Downing Street that has seen two senior advisers depart in 24 hours. Earlier, a spokesman for Keir Starmer insisted he's not resigning and will be concentrating on the job in hand. Anna Mihailova is Times Radio's political editor. She's in Downing Street.
He's holed up in Number 10 right now. His chief whip, Jonathan Reynolds, is in there, as is one of his PPSs. And you can expect Reynolds to be passing on messages from Labour MPs, and they will be discussing Keir Starmer's future and whether or not he can cling on. But Anna Sawa's intervention might well change things very, very quickly.
Thames Valley Police says it's assessing claims that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sent confidential government information to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Emails appear to show the former Duke sharing reports of official visits as government trade envoy. A nursery worker in Bristol has been found guilty of several sexual offences against children in his care. Nathan Bennett, who's 30 and from Bath, was convicted of 8 charges relating to 5 children who attended the nursery where he worked. And European Union regulators have warned Meta it may be blocking rival AI chatbots from WhatsApp, risking harm to competition. They say they're considering interim measures to force access. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Tesco Finest Sourdough. The real breadwinner. Untoasted, really toasted, or buttered right to the edges. Whatever floats your toast. It's delicious either way. It's why only the finest bakers take 24 hours to carefully craft our sourdough. Mmm. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
Experience every rhythm of life in Antalya, Turkey. Find your calm on golden sand. Dive into blue. Feel grand. Savor the flavors as day turns to night. Dance till the morning light. Live every rhythm of life in one single vacation in Antalya. Go Turkey.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new. Tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go, la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
It's Jane and Fee with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. So the Scottish Labour leader, Anna Sawyer, is going to give a press conference. The cameras are in place. The podium is empty at the moment. So as soon as he starts talking, we will cross live to that. But let's catch up with John Boothman in the meantime, the political correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times. John, it's no secret as to what Anna Sawyer is going to say. And in fact, he can tell us now.
Over the last few days, and I am clear that I have to do what's right for my country, Scotland. This isn't easy, and it's not without pain, as I have a genuine friendship with Keir Starmer. But my first priority and my first loyalty is to my country, Scotland. And I am not willing to sacrifice Scotland's NHS, our schools, our communities, our towns, cities, villages and islands to a third decade of an SNP government. That's why the distraction needs to end and the leadership in Downing Street has to change. It is so obvious that we desperately need change in Scotland. And in 3 months' time, the opportunity to get rid of a failing SNP government is one that is too important to be missed. We cannot allow the failures at the heart of Downing Street to mean the failures continue here in Scotland. Because the election in May is not without consequence for the lives of Scots. We have an NHS crisis where too many Scots can't access the treatment they need and when they need it. We have a housing emergency with more than 10,000 Scottish children homeless right now. And we have too many young people not feeling safe at school or on our streets or missing out on the opportunities they deserve. And we have an SNP government that is addicted to secrecy and cover-ups with devastating consequences. That's why I have to be honest about failure wherever I see it. The situation in Downing Street is not good enough. There have been too many mistakes. They promised they were going to be different, but too much has happened. Have there been good things? Of course there have. Many of them. But no one knows them and no one can hear them because they're being drowned out. That's why it cannot continue. I am proud to have played my part in removing a Tory government that was doing so much damage to Scotland. And having a Labour government matters. I am proud of my Scottish Labour MPs who did the hard work, persuaded our fellow Scots, ran a historic and successful campaign and who have spent every day since fighting for Scotland's interests. I'm proud of these Scottish Labour ministers serving at every level of government, delivering for Scotland. I want them to stay in government because I said right at the start that my first priority and my first loyalty is to my country, Scotland. That's why they must continue to defend and protect Scotland's interests. Keir Starmer is a decent man. And it is no secret that I have always got on well with him, and he has dedicated his life to public service. I have also dedicated myself to public service, and I need to decide what I'm willing to accept and what I'm willing to tolerate. The people of this great country, Scotland, are crying out for competent government, for transparency, for honesty, and for delivery. They want to see politics that is open and accountable. They want to see leaders who put the national interest before themselves. That is the standard I will always apply. In 3 months, we have an election that must be about one thing and one thing only: Scotland. That is my duty. That is my priority. That is my loyalty. And that is Scotland's choice. Thank you. I'll open up for some questions. I'll take Glen Campbell from the BBC.
Alistair Warr, just spell out why you want change and why you think that will end what you call distraction. Wouldn't it just plunge your party and the country into further chaos as a new leader is sought?
I think the reality is, Glenn, that there are so many achievements of a UK Labour government, so many good things that are happening across our country. But if you ask people, they can't see them and they can't hear them because the leadership in Downing Street has become a huge distraction. And I've had to think about my own priority, and my own priority, my first loyalty, is to Scotland. And Scotland needs to fundamentally take the opportunity for change here in Scotland in 3 months' time.
But who do you want to replace Keir Starmer? And is that...
Look, let me be... Let me be really clear. I am not supporting or backing any alternative or any candidate. This is not about MPs versus MSPs. This is about what is right for Scotland. And it is for the UK Cabinet. It is for Downing Street. It is for the UK Labour Party to decide any process, any timeline, and what comes next. Colin Mackay from STB.
You told me on Thursday you thought that Keir Starmer would still be Prime Minister come the election in May. What's changed since Thursday?
Well, what I said to you, Colin, was that yes, he could, but we needed answers. And I think, to be honest, the answers are, and the issues are much broader now. There have been too many incidences where the wrong judgment calls have been made. There have been too many mistakes, and that is distracting from the vital work of government, and it's also distracting from the big choice that people in Scotland have to make in 3 months' time, and that's why I think it needs to change in Downing Street.
Have you told the Prime Minister?
Well, that's where we're going to leave the press conference, keeping one ear across it. Let's check in with John Boothman, the political correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times. John, I've written down on my piece of paper in front of me, ouch, and that's echoed by Nick, one of our listeners, who says, yikes, with friends like these. What did you make of it? Come in, John. Hello, John Boothman.
Oh, that's annoying, isn't
it? That is, isn't it? John, are you there? We're just going to give it a little second there. It was interesting that immediately Anna Sawar was being pressed on who it might be that would prove to not be a distraction if Keir Starmer is the distraction. And he very clearly removed himself from the need to answer that question. So he is a man who knows what he doesn't want, but he couldn't tell anybody what exactly it is that he does want at the moment. He referenced the May elections, and obviously they are looming, so we will carry on talking about that. Anna Mikhailova, I think, can join us now in Downing Street.
Yes, hello, Anna. Hello. Can you hear us all right?
Yes, I can.
Brilliant. Let's go to Downing Street then. Times Radio's political editor, Anna, can talk to us. So, apart from perhaps Larry the Cat on the prowl, what is actually in view there? What's going on?
So Pat McFadden, the chief whip, has been inside Downing Street with Keir Starmer, as is one of his PPSs. We've had the occasional MP come in and out, but broadly, I think what we're seeing is an attempt to mount a rearguard action to save the Prime Minister. So just in the last few minutes, David Lammy, the Deputy Prime Minister, Steve Reid and Pat McFadden have sent supportive messages. And a Downing Street spokesman, after Sawar's intervention, has said that Keir Starmer has he won a big majority and he has a mandate. So effectively, the PM for now is digging in, but I just spoke to someone who is close to one of the potential successors who says that this is now the springboard for what happens next, and they expect ministers to start resigning. So it's really a watch this space moment.
Goodness me, right, it's as serious as that for Sir Keir Starmer then. Can you remind us, Anna, of what the procedure would be for selecting a new Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party?
So some of the things being talked about is, you know, the Prime Minister may not go straight away. So, for example, he could be persuaded to stay on for a little bit after the locals or even until the summer. That's one scenario that's just been discussed. But I think that's the key. It's so far, it's all about people saying they have to persuade him. So the mechanism for getting rid of a Labour Prime Minister or party leader is pretty difficult, as we know. And without that formal mechanism of triggering a contest by having 80 MPs, named MPs, backing someone to trigger it, the other option effectively involves ministers telling him and making his position untenable. So it's calls to resign or actual ministers quitting the government, I think, is what would
okay.
like to
do something. It isn't beyond the bounds of possibility that he resigns and goes immediately and is replaced by, well, presumably in the short term, David Lammy?
Well, there's speculation that there could be a caretaker situation, but as I say, it could also be Keir Starmer saying, I'll hang on for a few months while the party picks a successor. Neither option is obviously being at all leaned into by Downing Street, who continue to say that the Prime Minister is getting on with the job and he's the best person for the job. But it is unbelievably feeble right now, and the Anna Sawar intervention is extremely significant.
And just very briefly again, the final decision on who leads the Labour Party is made by Labour Party members, and they are, well, you tell me, more likely to go for a left-of-centre candidate.
Yeah, I mean, current polling that and focus groups suggest just that. So the two most popular figures tend to be Angela Rayner and Andy Burnham. But of course, Andy Burnham is not an MP. But yeah, I think we can expect a more soft left shift. But Wes Streeting, who is one of the main candidates, is obviously more to the right of centre of the party. And MPs might decide there's more of a mandate for a candidate like that. But I think, look, we're slightly getting ahead of ourselves with that. I think if that were to happen and the contest would be triggered, that would involve every candidate setting out their stall. And you could also expect some more unusual names, less talked about names coming forward as well.
Really interesting. Thank you very much. Keep in touch. That's Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mihailova, reporting from, I'm going to go febrile, from a febrile Downing Street.
Excellent choice of words. Now, break glass in case of emergency. It's Callum MacDonald. Callum, good afternoon.
Hello, Fee and Jane. How are you?
Yeah, yes, we're very good, well. Nobody knows Holyrood quite as well as you do, Callum. So what a perfect person to talk to about what's just happened. If this is the Scottish Labour leader, Anna Sawar's attempt to put some distance between him and Westminster, did that do it?
I think, Fee, this is astonishing in its significance, but completely unsurprising in the fact it's come to pass. Scottish Labour have absolutely tanked in the polls since Keir Starmer won the general election in 2024. Before that, Anas Sarwar was measuring for New Curtains in Bute House, the official residence of the First Minister of Scotland. Such was his luck on people's frustration with the SNP over nearly 20 years in government, and the sure thing that actually people would come to him for change. I'm not sure this intervention puts enough distance between him and Starmer, certainly not with enough time. The election in Scotland will be early in May, that first Thursday in May. He's got about 3 months to try and turn this round. And the numbers that Anas Sarwar is currently up against suggest, right now, polling from last week suggests that Scottish Labour would return 15 MSPs, that in front of them would be Reform UK on 23 MSPs, and the SNP would be the biggest party at Holyrood with 60 MSPs. I'm not sure Sarwar can claw that back. Many have said for some time that he needs to do something to distance himself from Starmer. Indeed, on a podcast that I host, we ran a focus group a couple of weeks ago in Falkirk, along with More in Common, I should say, the pollsters, and they, the group in Falkirk, still cited winter fuel payment as a problem for them. They had a hotel in their constituency that housed asylum seekers and migrants. They pointed to that as an issue for them. These issues will not be fixed by this particular intervention from Sarwar. He's going to have to go some to try and pick up the numbers between now and May.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious problem also is, you know, if you're saying that Starmer is the problem and you want to get away from Starmer, there is a void if you don't say what you think the solution is.
Yes, exactly. He said in that press conference he isn't going to back anyone in particular. It's for a process to happen within the Westminster Party of Labour. Now, I think the other part of that for Anas Sarwar is that he is going to be lambasted by the SNP. He is going to be picked apart by voters for his support for Sir Keir Starmer over these last few, well, last couple of years, I suppose, really, during the general election campaign and in the time that has passed since. I mean, even in the last few days, he has expressed support for Starmer. He's criticised those who've been kind of briefing against him and MPs who've been kind of agitating for a change of leadership. These are difficult things to get away from as a politician, even if the sensible, pragmatic, you know, grown-up part of our brain says, yes, people change their minds. In politics, it's not as simple as that. It can look dangerously like opportunism. It can look like trying to get ahead of the pack. And I think that Sarwar is going to face those accusations between now and
then. Yeah.
The other thing... Oh, sorry, go on.
I was just going to ask you, and it may be what you're about to say, there is a danger, isn't there, when you say, you know, we were great friends, he's a really decent man, I've always admired him, but I don't like him now. You know, yes. it really fuels that feeling that people have about the cynicism of politicians.
This is exactly it, exactly that they're out for themselves, and let's be real, that's at the heart of this Mandelson Starmer scandal that we've been reporting on over the last couple of weeks. This sense of politics is there to try and get ahead in your own interest. I think that the other part of this is about how much backing Sarwar now gets. So there are 37 Scottish MPs, or MPs from Scottish constituencies, I should say. One source that I've been speaking to here from Mission Control in my living room, where my phone is about to melt, I think. One source I've been speaking to says that these MPs, these 37 MPs, simply have to back Anas Sarwar. Although one MP I've had a message from this afternoon says, we're going to be asked about our support from now until May. Are you Team Sarwar or are you Team Starmer? Now, I suspect that particular deadline of May is actually wishful thinking. These MPs are going to have to make a decision far sooner than that as to whether they think the PM should stay or they back the Scottish Labour leader in saying that the Prime Minister has to go. Just one note on that as well for you, Fee, is that the co-chair of the Scottish Labour election campaign alongside Anas Sarwar is the Cabinet Minister, the Secretary of State for Scotland, Douglas Alexander, who has been around politics for decades, and one wonders where he's going to come down in all of this, or if he tries to tread something of a neutral line. I'm just not sure that particularly makes sense in the context.
We will let you get back to busy Mission Control. Very glad we got a chance to talk to you. That is Times Radio's Callum McDonald.
Interesting thoughts from you. Phil says, simply saying not Starmer isn't a grown-up option for Sarwar. Politics is about choice, not just a void. He risks looking like Douglas Ross. He was the Tory, wasn't he, who opposed, then withdrew, then opposed Boris. He went to electoral oblivion. So I think Sarwar should take note. Keith says, what a time to be alive. David Lammy could be Prime Minister by end of the week. Send help. That's Keith's view. By the end of the day, Keith. But look, we don't know any of this for certain. It's all wild speculation. But also worth saying, slightly sinister warning from Harvey, who just says, watch Sterling. Well, I have just checked on the value of sterling, and it's 1.14 euros. Has gone down a little, but no real drama there, Harvey. So perhaps we just need to get in the braced position and hope for the very best.
Well, Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, has come out in the last couple of minutes to really back Keir Starmer. And this is how it's going to be, isn't it? Until some kind of decision is made.
She says we're turning the country round.
There you go. Should social media be banned from letting you scroll forever? That is one of the tech stories we're going to try and squeeze in. Understandably, we're a little bit late for these. It's 3:09. Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture, and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit oceaniacruises.com or your travel agent.
McDonald's wraps, all flavor, no mess. No drips on your drip or grease on your shirt. No crumbs on your keyboard or sauce on your dashboard. Just all the flavor of sweet chili chicken, barbecue and bacon chicken and new tikka chicken. Wrapped up neat.
Served after 11 a.m. Tikka chicken wrap available until the 13th July 26. Fees apply to delivery orders, subject to availability.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Chris Stokel-Walker joins us to tell us all about this week's big tech stories. The EU has told TikTok it must change its addictive design or face massive fines. This is about unlimited scrolling, isn't it, Chris?
It is one amongst many things that are seen as offensive to the European Union. So they have come out late last week, Fee, and said that this is not acceptable under the EU's Digital Services Act, which is a bit of legislation designed to try and protect the rights of users against overreach by big tech companies, including TikTok and many, many others. They say that this is addictive design, and so you are not allowed to have this in the European Union, the regulations have decreed, unless you make some mitigations. And currently, TikTok is not doing enough to try and avoid that. So now they are being threatened with the risk of a pretty significant fine, up to 6% of parent company ByteDance's overall revenue. They had something like $180-odd billion last year, we believe, unless they choose to make a change.
Is the EU pretty much the only global outlier in its attempts to curb the darker side of tech?
They're not any more, actually, and this is one of the things that is really interesting. They were very much in the vanguard. We've talked for many months, many years now, of the fact that they are the ones leading the way on this, but it feels like there is an increasing head of steam. We saw, of course, with the UK last year, the Online Safety Act, designed to do similar sorts of things, albeit not quite as interventionist. The real outlier, I suppose, is the United States, where, of course, Donald Trump wants to try and make sure that American tech companies are the world-leading ones, particularly in competition with China. And so they say, actually, we'll have a little bit of a hands-off approach in terms of regulation, and whatever you want to do pretty much goes.
Right. Let's talk about the price of Bitcoin, which has fallen to its lowest level in 16 months. That's despite Donald Trump's increasing support. What's gone on here? What's triggered this?
I think that there is an increasing awareness that actually the hype is not living up to the promise, and particularly given that Donald Trump's support of this sort of stuff can often be here today and gone tomorrow. So if you had bought Bitcoin back in October, then you would have paid around about $122,000 for a single Bitcoin. That is now halved, and it's the lowest price that we've seen, as you say, around about 18 months since September 2024. Really, I think this is the reality starting to hit here, and also a little bit of a fear, I suppose, about the broader economy. Of course, the big tech bubble and the fears around AI there, these things are increasingly intertwined. And I think that as Bitcoin was meant to be some sort of insulation against fiat currency issues, it's actually turning out that the closer these two things intertwine, you know, Jane was just talking about the price of the pound against the euro before we went to the break. That is, I think, a reality now for Bitcoin, is real-world impact on currencies has an impact also on Bitcoin and other crypto.
And have lots of other cryptocurrencies just gone?
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting thing. I wrote a study that was done by some researchers in Europe just this week as well, which showed that a lot of these meme coins that we've talked about previously, the ones that are trying to capture the zeitgeist, sometimes they're named after funny characters or things like that. 1 in 20 of those actually don't last 24 hours, a single day in existence, because effectively this sort of thing is the Wild West. It is unregulated by design, and in theory, theory, that sounds good, but in practice, what actually happens is people think that they can make a quick buck from a kind of scam sort of project and end up pulling the rug on it.
Did Melania's meme coin last more than 24 hours?
I think you can still buy that, but to be honest, I don't know if I would necessarily. I think the price of that is probably tanked, just like maybe her film box office revenues did.
Yes, I didn't make time to see it, I'm ashamed to say. There is a new unexpected teenage TikTok trend. Let's have a listen.
And now the company jumps when he plays Reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
He was a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Well, it's new, but it's old, isn't it, Chris? What's going on?
Yeah, three teenagers from good old Yorkshire. They were brought together to sing at the 80th anniversaries of VE Day in Ripon last May, and basically realised that they were very, very good at singing. They were capturing this moment of time in history, basically representing the kind of post-war era, and it turns out that they've become incredibly popular on TikTok. So it just goes to show that sometimes we talk about all of the really complicated modern bits of culture on TikTok, but then also sometimes you just want a little bit of tradition as well.
So I suppose the story really is that young people are liking something that is incredibly old. I mean, it's not like lots of older people are on TikTok and therefore giving them the thumbs up.
No, I mean, there are a broad range of people on TikTok from all sorts of different generations and backgrounds.
But there aren't lots of 70 and 80-year-olds, are there, Chris?
No, that is true. And I think it taps into a sort of broader feeling around things like trad wives. So in the United States, there is this massive movement towards trying to replicate a bygone era, that kind of nuclear family in the US in the 1950s. I imagine this is our, you know, the very best of British tradition, our kind of slightly shonky, not quite as good version of that in terms of we were living through rationing and all sorts of issues there.
Yeah, I tell you what, Jane and I could start up a little TikTok channel called Shonky Wives.
Yeah, why? Let's go for it. Apparently those amazing TikTok sensation crooner girls were going to be on Kathy Newman's show.
Brilliant.
On Times Radio on Friday.
Excellent. We'll keep you posted.
They are good, aren't they? I like that kind of thing. I'd like to hear their version of Yes, We Have No Bananas.
I think we're probably the only afternoon show that's played that and Bad Bunny in the same 45 minutes. I like to think so. Chris Stokel-Walker, it's always lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed, Chris. We'll be back at the same time next week. Any part of the tech world that you would like him to cast his very, very good journalistic eye over, do get in touch with us, 0333 003 2353.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, 3 o'clock, you're with Times Radio and it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until four. Could be quite a busy hour, it has to be said. Just in the last couple of minutes, more cabinet ministers have weighed in, backing the PM, John Healey, the Defence Secretary and the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper. Yvette Cooper talking about the Prime Minister being in position to lead the British delegation to the Munich Security Conference later in the week. So they are very much backing the PM. So in the next hour, what else? Well, we'll talk politics, certainly. We'll discuss the VAR pandemonium at Anfield yesterday. And Adam Shaw will investigate the interesting world of so-called quirky investments. And in our literary salon with Laura Hackett today after 3:30, we're going to take a fresh look at a James Joyce classic. Oh, yes, we are. Here's the news at 3, Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The leader of Scottish Labour has become the most senior figure in the party to call on Sir Keir Starmer to quit. The Prime Minister is under growing pressure over the appointment of Peter Mandelson as ambassador to Washington. Two key Downing Street figures have resigned in the past 24 hours. At a press conference, Anna Sawyer said the Prime Minister is a decent man, but the people of Scotland are crying out for competent government.
The distraction needs to end and the leadership in Downing Street has to change. I have to be honest about failure wherever I see it. The situation in Downing Street is not good enough. There have been too many mistakes. They promised they were going to be different, but too much has happened.
Meanwhile, multiple sources have told The Times the Labour First Minister in Wales, Elynydd Morgan, has the same view as Sauer on the Prime Minister's future. But a Downing Street spokesman insists Sir Keir Starmer has a clear five-year mandate from the British people and will stay the course. A number of senior ministers have also weighed in supporting the Prime Minister. Times Radio's political editor Anna Mihailova is in Downing Street.
Effectively, the PM for now is digging in. I just spoke to someone close to one of the potential successors who says that this is now the springboard for what happens next, and they expect ministers to start resigning. So it's really a watch this space moment.
Police are looking into claims that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor exploited his work as trade envoy for the government by passing information to Jeffrey Epstein. Thames Valley Police say they're assessing information that appears to show he shared confidential files in emails released by the US Department of Justice. Meanwhile, the King has again been heckled over Andrew's links to Epstein as the Prince and Princess of Wales make their first public statement on the issue. William and Kate are said to be deeply concerned. His longtime Times Royal correspondent, Valentine Lowe.
They're desperate not to have this issue overshadow William's trip to Saudi Arabia. He's there for 3 days. It's an important trip. And they don't want this issue, which has dragged on for months and years, to dominate the agenda. It's slightly too little too late. I mean, why didn't they say something an awful lot earlier?
A Jewish MP has visited a Bristol school in secret after an earlier trip was blocked. Damien Egan's visit to Bristol Brunel Academy was stopped after planned protests by pro-Palestine groups opposed to his role in Labour Friends of Israel. The MP for Bristol North East says the rescheduled visit was lovely. And a yellow weather warning has come into force with heavy rain expected across southwest England and South Wales. The alert runs until midnight tonight. The Met Office warns of travel disruption and cuts to electricity. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So you will hear things as they happen on Times Radio. We don't go to tapes. We don't go to dramas. Nobody sits down and has a snooze. Anna Mihailova is at Downing Street this afternoon, and the commendations are coming in for Keir Starmer, but condemnations as well. Downing Street has insisted that the Prime Minister will not quit following Anna Sawa's call for him to resign. Let's remind ourselves of what the Scottish Labour leader has said this afternoon.
This isn't easy, and it's not without pain, as I have a genuine friendship with Keir Starmer. But my first priority and my first loyalty is to my country, Scotland. And I am not willing to sacrifice Scotland's NHS, our schools, our communities, our towns, cities, villages and islands to a third decade of an SNP government. That's why the distraction needs to end and the leadership in Downing Street has to change.
It comes as Sir Keir Starmer's Director of Communications, Tim Allen, resigned just one day after his Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, quit. The Prime Minister has had messages of support, though, from the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, as well as a host of Cabinet Ministers. So David Lammy, Steve Reid, Darren Jones, Liz Kendall, Yvette Cooper and John Healey, all standing beside him, notably missing Ed Miliband and Wes Streeting, although Wes Streeting was doorstepped and he simply didn't reply when asked if he would support Starmer. More on this story as we get it.
You are with Times Radio, 3:05. Well, Hong Kong's most high-profile China critic, the British media tycoon Jimmy Lai, has been sentenced to 20 years in prison. Now, this ends Hong Kong's biggest national security trial and is prompting international concern over the erosion of freedoms in China. Jimmy Lai is 78. He's a pro-democracy campaigner, as you know. He was convicted on 2 counts of conspiring to collude with foreign forces and 1 count of publishing seditious materials. Now, he denied all the charges, telling the court he's a political prisoner facing persecution. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has described that 20-year sentence as tantamount to a life sentence. Well, Sebastian Lai is Jimmy Lai's son. Sebastian, this must be exceptionally tough for you. How are you?
Obviously it was expected.
but it makes it no less heartbreaking and devastating. I think there was a moment of sort of a bittersweet moment, I should say, when they passed the sentence and my father was stoic. You know, here's a man who's given all he can to his beliefs. He was stoic and he even flashed a smile in almost like a little act of rebellion. He wasn't going to show any sadness. And in some sense, we knew that this was going to happen. He knew that it was going to happen even 30 years ago when he first started campaigning for democracy, that this was a very high possibility. But he did so regardless because it was the right thing to do.
Now, I know for you and for the rest of your family, Sebastian, this is a deeply personal family story and something you are incredibly closely connected to. I suppose for the rest of us, the fate of your father might be seen as, let's be honest, another failure of Keir Starmer's leadership. He was in China. He was supposed to make the case for your father. And the result is a 20-year prison sentence. What would you say about that?
Like many people have called out for my father's release. The Prime Minister said that he mentioned it to Xi Jinping, and this is an opportunity because, you know, as we get closer relationships with China, issues like my father's case can be raised. He said that it's a priority, and I am inclined to believe him. But look, this is a test. This is a litmus test because we gave a AAA and an embassy away to China, and we haven't really seen anything come back to this nation. And if they're not even willing to put a 78-year-old man on a plane whose business they've taken away, health they destroyed, then what can we possibly expect from a relationship with China? How can we normalize relationships when there's this huge glaring issue of my father's imprisonment that we will never normalize? We will never normalize a British citizen who is in these horrible conditions that he's in for standing up for what is right. That is something that is unacceptable.
But you are content that the Prime Minister did what he promised and did raise the issue of your father's confinement?
No, obviously I'm not content.
I'm saying, do you, you believe that he did indeed do it, at least?
Yeah, I mean, he said in Parliament, I think that he did do it. I think, again, it's a real test for the government. I think time will tell whether that was the right thing or wrong thing to do. And obviously, I don't think that he should have gone over until my father was out. But if the belief is that by going over, cases like these can be raised, which is what he said, then we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, multiple world leaders have also gone over and mentioned my father's name. I think this is a case now where there's global attention and people see how cruel it is. People are very touched by my father's story. And I think what's happening to him is a perfect example of how Hong Kong's rule of law has been destroyed and how cruel and vindictive that government is.
Perhaps it's just worth reminding people what he was found guilty of. What are these national security offences?
Sure. So the national security law was passed at the end of 2020. It was widely seen as incredibly draconian. Essentially, even speaking to you right now, criticising the Hong Kong government, I could be found guilty of the national security law, even if I do so in the United Kingdom. So my father got charged with a collusion with foreign forces, which in his case, he got 20 years for. But look, I think it's interesting to look into this, right? Because collusion necessitates some benefit. And after 5 years of arresting my father, after allegations of tortured witnesses, after a kangaroo court, what they have found was that the benefit that my father would have had in campaigning for democracy was democracy. Big reveal. It's one vote and the knowledge that with his life, with his work, he made Hong Kong a freer and better place. So it's an absolute insane charge. And I mean, the whole 5 years has been, you know, many of these kind of moments where they're essentially sending all these highly trained lawyers to do a job that anyone can do. They've destroyed their legal system.
Yeah, I should say I've just been handed a press release which outlines a press statement from the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The statement says the Hong Kong High Court's decision to sentence Jimmy Lai to 20 years is an unjust and tragic conclusion to the case. It shows the world that Beijing will go to extraordinary lengths to silence those who advocate fundamental freedoms in Hong Kong. After enduring a trial lasting 2 years and detention in prison for more than five, Mr. Lai and his family have suffered enough. The US urges the authorities to grant Mr. Lai humanitarian parole. I mean, do you think that might lead somewhere, Sebastian?
I think international pressure is crucial if we're ever going to see my father again. And we're so incredibly grateful for the support of both Secretary of State Rubio and also the you know President Trump. Look, it's you know as I said, it's gotten to a place where many people view my father as a hero. Many people view what's happening to him as extremely cruel, and more importantly, extremely unnecessary from the Hong Kong and Chinese government. You know, in the 5 years, they found nothing, and all they've done is nearly killed this man. And so it's not only the humane thing to do to send him back to the UK, it's also the rational thing to do.
We know that his health is not brilliant. He is nearly 80. Do you have any idea what his current state of health is? I took your point earlier that you were encouraged by his slightly defiant demeanour at sentencing. But what else do you know about how he is?
So my father's health has deteriorated massively over the last few years. In fact, my sister, who recently left Hong Kong to campaign on his behalf as well, has said that, you know, throughout the last 5 years, you see this man slowly deteriorating. Over the last year alone, he's lost 10 kilos. For context, he's being kept in solitary confinement this whole time. So 14 days is prolonged solitary confinement. He's been kept in solitary confinement for 1,800 days. And that has obviously very clear mental tools, but also clear physical tools. So he now has heart issues. There's times when his fingernails fall off, when his teeth are rotting. And in the summer, in that little cell of his, that measure maybe 60 square feet, where natural light is blocked off, it goes up to 30, 40 degrees Celsius. And so essentially bakes in there. It's heartbreaking and unnecessarily cruel.
So Britain has said it's going to carry on doing what it can. Yvette Cooper says the British government intends to rapidly engage further with Beijing. Marco Rubio is also calling for your father to be released. The plain fact is that the Chinese authorities don't appear to care very much at all what Western governments think. Isn't that right?
No, I don't think that's right. I mean, Hong Kong still says that it has the rule of law, not because it's a nice thing for them to say. They say that because Hong Kong's a financial center. It's still based on the trust that contracts will be honored, the law will be respected, that you will get a fair trial. And by doing what they're doing to my father, they're destroying that. They essentially weaponized this legal system that, you know, for decades on end had this incredible reputation And so they do still care. They do still care how the international community think. And especially in a case where they've shown such cruelty publicly, they still care. And I think releasing my father at this point will be directly beneficial to both Hong Kong and China.
I'm really interested and encouraged by the fact that you haven't entirely given up hope. I wonder whether, though, he might be released but then told that he mustn't ever speak out of turn. Would he ever accept a release on those terms, that perhaps he comes to live in Britain but is never allowed to speak in public about the fate of Hong Kong again?
I can't speak on his behalf, but you know, it's he's a man who's given everything that he has for freedom and liberty. I think someone who's spent so much of his life campaigning for the freedom of others deserves some freedom himself.
Thank you very much indeed for your time. It must be an incredibly difficult time for you and indeed for the rest of your family. That is Sebastian Lai, who's the son of Jimmy Lai, sentenced to 20 years in prison.
It's just a simple fact, though, Jane, isn't it, that there was a moment of leverage over the planning permission for the super embassy in London, where you could see a logical argument that the British government could say, you want a big space in our democracy, you want to come and enjoy our free press. Well, there's something that you might be able to show us that would mean we believe you about that. But that moment well and truly passed.
And the embassy is going to happen.
News just in. Well, on two fronts, Ed Miliband has, in the last couple of minutes, tweeted in support of Sir Keir Starmer. And an exclusive from Beth Rigby, who has spoken to Wes Streeting for her Electoral Dysfunction podcast in the last hour, and acknowledges that the atmosphere is febrile. This is Wes Streeting, not Beth, and has told her that Keir Starmer doesn't need to resign. It's not been the best week for the government. Give Keir a chance. That is a direct quote from Wes Streeting, who was talking to Beth Rigby. Jane and Fee at times.radio is our email. Very busy on the WhatsApp, 0333 003 2353. We will get to as many of your messages as we can in the next 10 minutes or so of the programme. Coming up as well, why has last night's Liverpool City match triggered a new row about governing football? Vassas Alexander the Great will be in with our thought, sport, sport, thought, pause for thought, pause for sport. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio, delete as applicable. With Wix, the kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk, or why not just pop along to your local Wix store.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation.
Is it just me that strikes me there's a whiff of nonsense about the deal?
Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself.
Even while it drags on and as horrifying as it is, it should have been a foreign policy triumph.
Plus unique perspectives on the day's news.
There seems to be a theme here, and that is that no one knows what's going on.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Discover the world of Dobble, back in McDonald's Happy Meal. Race through the worlds of music, sports, space and more. How quickly can your little one spot the match? Dobble's bursting with fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 5th of March 2026, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy. Dobble range comprises toys only, while stocks last.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel. Idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
In depth, obviously.
We could have in depth on the front of the T-shirt and obviously on the back. Oh, dear.
I would buy one of those T-shirts.
We were caught showing our petticoat there, Vassas Alexander. Hello, how are you?
I blame myself a bit for that. I'm very well, thank you.
You should blame yourself entirely.
Do you know what? We were all talking about the Winter Olympics and just those horrible, horrible scenes. You're watching it live. You're watching a sportswoman in action. This is Lindsay Vonn. You are really gunning for her because her bravery is extraordinary in having such a terrible injury and still competing. But there's a bit of you that's also going, uh-oh, and the uh-oh happened.
Yeah, I mean, last she was competitor number 13 and her return from injury lasted 13 seconds and it was a very hard watch. You could, you know, if you had the volume up, you could hear her scream of pain. And she said, oh, my God, as the medics arrived. And she clipped a gate. She fell at 60 miles an hour. She was competing, for those who didn't follow the story, 9 days after rupturing her ACL. And just to put that in some kind of context, it takes footballers 9 to 12 months to recover from an ACL injury. She had a knee brace on. We hear she has badly broken her leg. Her life is not in danger, but it will take, according to the US Ski Federation, it'll take some sorting out.
Yeah.
And you know, and listening to the BBC coverage, and Shemi Orcott, who's a four-time Team GB downhill racer, and she was in tears as she was saying, like, I feel guilty, she said, about being so emotional about this, but it is just very, very hard to see. And you do hope, because Lindsay Vonn, who's just such a huge star in America, she came back to skiing after 5 years out. And you just hope that the presence of a Netflix crew chronicling her return to the sport didn't influence her decision.
Oh, I didn't realise they were involved.
Yeah.
Oh,
And I don't think it would have done. I mean, it does raise the question, you know, when does the athlete have the final decision?
Right.
As to whether they compete. It was an awful watch, but, you know, thank goodness she's going to be OK.
OK, so that is the main thing. Thank goodness she's going to be OK. Just before we move off this topic, we were talking last week about whether or not there comes a point when authorities have to say, do you know what, we don't think you should be racing. If you're that close to injury, you know, what's the process by which an athlete is kind of signed off?
Well, the key principle here is athletes can choose pain, but they cannot choose unacceptable risk. There are some sports, football, rugby, I mean, many sports, American football, we had the Super Bowl last night, where there is a clear concussion protocol and they just follow that to the letter. I mean, when you've got a dodgy knee and you say, well, I can ski on. She was, in her second practice run, she was third quickest. So she would have been standing in that. Did you see her in the start gate? She was sort of geeing herself up to go. She would have been thinking, this is it. This is the greatest comeback. I'm going to win an Olympic medal. And then it all unraveled 13 seconds later. I think what the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, what they do, it's a sort of deliberately conservative, indirect approach. I mean, they will say, we'll make the rules, but you sports and athletes, you make the decisions.
Yeah.
They won't ever step in and say, sorry, Lindsay Vonn, you can't ski.
Yeah, and we may never know whether or not she felt that her knee had made her vulnerable in the seconds, nanoseconds, minutes, hours, days or weeks before entering that race. Just one quick one. Is that you?
No.
Is that me?
It's him.
It's him. Oh, the terrible way you just went, no. It's a fibbing man, Jane. Should we carry on or should we kick him out? This one just in from Sehi says, good afternoon. My name is Sehi. My team and I would like to advertise on your website. Can we discuss the details? No. It's just the kind of stuff that comes into us here at Times Towers. Let's talk about the row over last night's Man City-Liverpool match and the call by VAR. Now, Gary Neville is amongst those who've condemned the decision, saying that the video assistant referee kills the joy of football. Well, I mean, that's one phrase that doesn't contain expletives. Most people would have expletives contained within the phrase.
Yeah, he said, there's the smell of a game. Just let the goal be. Listen to this from Martin Samuel writing on the Times web. This is so good. This is perfect. Everything was right, he says, except nothing was right. Nothing was wrong, except everything was wrong. And it all went off completely as it should, except everybody wished that it hadn't. So this is Manchester City's third goal, which was eventually ruled out thanks to the video assistant referee against Liverpool last night. The goal, it had a smell of Scotland's fourth goal against Denmark about it. You know, the Liverpool keeper, Alisson, is up that end of the pitch as Liverpool search for an equaliser. And Shirky, it was, who kicked the ball towards goal from his own half with no keeper guarding the net. And then there was a straight race between Haaland and Szoboszlai, Haaland of Man City and Szoboszlai of Liverpool, who was trying to prevent the goal being scored. Szoboszlai pulled Haaland back, and then Haaland pulled him back as he was about to clear the ball off the line. But the ball eventually went in the goal, and everyone says, well, that's obviously a goal, and that's one of the great moments of the season. And that's what everyone's worrying about, because look, we'd all remember that forever. That's the Manchester City goal that brings them back into that. I mean, it was just what the thing that fans get upset about with
Bassos,
VAR.
Take a breath.
The thing that they get upset about with VAR is, do you remember in the World Cup ages ago, there's an Italian player called Marco Tardelli who scored a goal, and then his celebration was just this sheer arms wide joy, a disbelief on his face as he wheeled away in celebration. And that moment, the goal, which is the ultimate currency in football, it's you score a goal and there's an eruption of joy. And there has to be a pause now. It's not just, oh, was it offside? It's like, oh, are VAR going to intervene here?
Yeah,
VAR going to intervene here? And it just seems like such a shame. Although, you have to say, VAR could not have allowed the goal to stand. It was factually wrong, so they were right.
it was wrong and they were right. Before VAR, would that goal have stood?
100%. Right. Like Gary Neville says, smell of the game.
Okay, as a sort of armchair fan, nothing excites me more than a goalkeeper going up to the other end of the pitch. That's just, to me, I love the drama of that.
And it happens less often than you'd think it would.
It doesn't happen very often at all, really, which is why I get very excited when I see it happening.
It's just great. I mean, you had a moment in the Champions League a couple of weeks ago where... It was Benfica. It was Jose Mourinho's Benfica up against his former club, Real Madrid. And both teams needed a goal. Benfica were winning, but they needed a goal for their, you know, the Champions League's one big league. Now, so basically, both teams needed a goal. So Benfica were time-wasting because they were winning, but then Jose said, go up, keeper. And in the 99th minute, the keeper scored the goal that put Benfica through to the knockout stages of the Champions League. What are the great moments? And if VAR had taken that away, you'd think, no, please. Anyway, that did stand, and I'm completely with you. A goalkeeper going up for a corner late in the game is just one of the lovely sights in football. And actually, you know, because... teams don't know how to quite defend that, because why would they? More often than not, it causes a bit of chaos that could lead to a goal.
Modern goalkeepers, the men are so tall, aren't
they? Yeah, exactly.
I think Alisson's 6'5" or 4 or 5. I mean, he's a big lad. I wish I could say his name, because I always want to praise him. He's such a good player.
Szoboszlai.
Yeah.
He's
the captain of Hungary. He's going to be the captain of Liverpool before much longer, I'm sure. I mean, Liverpool haven't had a brilliant season, but he's been brilliant in just about every game.
He has, and he scored one of the great free kicks. He scored against Arsenal, and then identikit free kick to put Liverpool 1-0 up against Man City yesterday from miles out.
Yeah.
Just fantastic. And then he was the player, unfortunately, for Liverpool and for himself, who got sent off after that goal was disallowed because he denied a clear goal-scoring chance. Yawn, yawn, yawn. But, you know, VAR did the right thing, but VAR did the wrong thing.
So the lovely quote that you pulled out from Martin Samuel's column ends with him saying, will anything change? Will anything change?
No, nothing will change because authorities value correctness more than they value, you know, the fan experience. And what they would tell you is that the problem isn't with VAR. The problem is how VAR is being used. You know, the lengthy was it offside question. Remember, we're waiting 5 minutes to find out if that goal's going to be ruled out. Actually, yesterday it happened quite quickly and they couldn't have changed what happened given that you have VAR. And, nowhere in any boardroom are they going to admit that actually VAR's a bit of a fiasco. Nobody likes it. Let's quietly get rid of it.
And it's definitely going to be around at the World Cup in the summer.
Oh, it's got sharper elbows at the World Cup. It might even be used to say, was it a corner or not?
Oh, you're joking.
Yeah,
sorry. Games are going to go on for 4 or 5
yes,
hours.
They are. Yes.
Right, okay. Are we allowed to know which team you support?
I support Fulham.
Okay. Right. I wondered whether you had some skin in the game when you went off on one at the beginning.
No.
You should know.
He's just very professional.
He is very professional, very excited by his job, as are we. What else is tickling your fancy at the Winter Olympics? Do you know what? It is lovely to have it on, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. There is.
You can get home of an evening, whatever it is that they're doing. I watched some big air qualifying.
Extraordinary.
Over the
I watched
weekend.
That last night.
OMG.
I know. I mean, the bravery and the sheer steepness of the slope. The Winter Olympics are great because it's generally against a white background, so everything looks really great. And these tricks that they pull out and the bravery of the people.
And they're so young, some of those competitors, aren't they?
I know, 16, 17. It's just,
They're
fearless and they come from gymnastics backgrounds, so what they're doing is just, it's a bit like diving, the sort of Winter Olympics equivalent of diving. These people come from, they are gymnasts, and then they do their stuff on the snow or the ice. I've been watching a bit of curling, and I'll leave you this, which was...
They're not young, are they? Not so young.
Not as young. They're not young.
There's somebody who posted me watching curling. After 1 minute, this is dull. After 10 minutes, he's overdone the turn of this stone. After 30 minutes, three in the house means nothing if your centre guard is ripe for a hit and roll. After an hour, sweep, sweep.
So true. Wow. It's addictive, all of it. It's an absolute pleasure to watch.
Isn't there some mixed curling tonight, Vassal? So I think
yes, absolutely. Yes, GB against Sweden in the semi-finals.
Right,
win that and we've won our first medal.
Unmissable. We'll be there. Thank you very much.
Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you both too.
It's Times Radio, and we've got our literary salon with Laura Hackett in a moment or two, and some personal finance with Adam Shaw as well before 4 o'clock, and any politics that occurs. Here are the headlines. It's Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Senior cabinet ministers are rallying around Sir Keir Starmer as the leader of Scottish Labour becomes the most senior party figure to call for his resignation. And potential successor Wes Streeting says the Prime Minister doesn't need to resign. A number of other ministers joined a coordinated show of support, including Science Secretary Liz Kendall.
I believe the Prime Minister should be given the space to make sure that it's not just his words, but the action we need to make sure that we deliver as a Labour government.
Thames Valley Police says it's assessing claims that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sent confidential information to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Emails appear to show the former Duke sharing reports of official visits as government trade envoy. A nursery worker in Bristol has been found guilty of several sexual offences against children in his care. Nathan Bennett, who's 30 and from Bath, was convicted of 8 charges relating to 5 children who attended the nursery where he worked. Shares in Greggs have taken a hit over worries over the use of weight loss drugs. They were down 6% earlier due to concerns the bakery chain's most regular customers will visit less often. Lindsay Vonn has undergone surgery after suffering a dramatic crash at the Winter Olympics. The US skier got hurt while competing in the women's downhill in Cortina yesterday, just days after rupturing ligaments in her left knee. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Up to an adult protected.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast. 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Kat would like to remind us it's the final of the women's big air tonight as well. I mean, it's not a phrase that I even knew before the Winter Olympics
came along. I'm embracing
it now. And now it's just wonderful. I cannot wait to get home to watch it. And Fiona says it's brilliant to hear Vassos on Times Radio being missed on the airwaves. Fiona, we think so too. So Vassos with us every afternoon.
He's got real jockstrap energy, hasn't he?
Hasn't he just?
And I think the programme's needed it.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Sort of half wish I hadn't said that now.
Yeah, the managing editor's just turned around there and he's giving us a bit of a look.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Again. And thank you to Caroline for her lovely image just sent in of her cat Ted watching the downhill skiing. Very much looking forward to the curling later, apparently. Yeah, cats do like the Winter Olympics. My Dora has shown a tiny amount of interest in the curling. So we'll see if she embraces a British success story tonight, because we're going for a medal, Laura. I don't suppose you literary types are that invested in all this, are you?
I was watching the skating last night.
Oh, well.
I thought it was incredible.
Yeah.
I kept gasping. And then when they fall over and they keep replaying it, it feels almost cruel. Well, I think just leave them
alone. No, but you want to see it, though, don't you?
As long as you know they've not been badly hurt. We all like a little bit of a tumble, don't we? Let's just be honest, we do. I saw a young Japanese lad doing an incredible routine. I think it was on Saturday night. Just absolutely amazing. Their skill set is incredible, but we're not here now to talk about that. We're here to talk about books. Laura is the deputy literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times, and we're going to talk about a couple of really notable debut novels. First of all, A Private Man by Stephanie, and I'm afraid I just can't pronounce the surname, so help me out.
I've been saying Sequeer,
okay,
and I'm hoping it's right.
Spelt? How is it spelled?
S-Y hyphen Q-U-I-A.
Okay.
She was born in California, but sort of raised in Britain and started off as a poet. Her poetry's won awards in the past, and now this is her first novel. And it's based really on her own family history. So she is the granddaughter of a Catholic priest and a laywoman.
It shouldn't really be possible.
It shouldn't be possible, but her grandfather decided to leave the church in order to marry the woman that he'd fallen in love with. And this novel really imagines their lives and how they came to make that really momentous decision. It's set between the 1950s, 1960s and the present day, where Adrian, who is his fictional character, the grandson, is looking after his grandmother, who's very old and has got dementia. And he's trying to figure out, before she loses her mind, what happened and why she made the decisions that she did. And then we go flashbacks through Margaret's own mind and David, the grandfather, the Catholic priest. And it really is just thrilling. It sounds like, obviously, you know that what decision they're going to make, but she manages to keep the tension really tight the whole time, that you're just sort of thinking, what are they going to do? Mm-hmm. And it's just really beautifully written as well. The scenery when they're in Rome in the Vatican, it makes you feel like you're there.
Okay, so is this, I'm always slightly wary of the literary novel. Is this literary or is it one of those enjoyable, not romps, but a story that drags you in and keeps you absolutely invested in the characters?
Well, this for me felt like my favourite kind of novel, which is one that kind of does both.
Right.
In that I thought the writing was really beautiful. It's a very kind of intellectual novel in a way, because the two characters are thinking really hard about the doctrine of the Catholic Church and the decisions that they have to make. But at the same time, it's this really kind of wonderful love story, and you don't know what they're going to do next or how they're going to get around these problems. So I'm sort of cheating by saying both, but I do think it is both.
Okay, so just a reminder, it's called A Private Man by Stephanie
Sequeira.
Okay, and you can find that now. It's out now.
It is out now, I believe, or at least out in the next few days.
Yes, okay. Sometimes you do get sneaky previews of things, don't you? You're a very lucky woman. Now, Rebecca Perry's May We Feed the King. This just sounds, fascinating. Tell me about this.
So this is narrated by a person, and it's a kind of person that you obviously know exists, but I'd never really thought about, which is the person who makes, when you go to a stately home, when you go to a National Trust property.
And by the way, we do, don't we?
All the time, I'm
sure. Often, yeah.
Yes. And you go into those rooms and it's set out like it would have been back in the day. You know, you've got the bed and you've got the table with the feast on it, and it's all plastic food or whatever. It's narrated by the person who comes up with those displays and makes them. And she is sent to this stately home and told, right, we're going to do this exhibition.
So this is a contemporary setting, this
It's
bit.
Set in the contemporary time, right. Yes. Okay. And she's researching this particular stately home and the people who lived there in order to come up with her display. And while she does that, she becomes really obsessed with one particular medieval monarch. Now, we don't know exactly who it is. It isn't told it's Henry IV or whatever.
British monarch or
British
English.
Monarch, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And she just becomes really obsessed with his life, going through the archives, trying to imagine what it would have been like. And then the novel switches gear and we kind of go back in time and see the same home that she's trying to decorate and design at the time of that particular medieval king. And he's an unusual king because he's the third brother. His two older brothers have died, so he never thought that he would become king. And he doesn't really want to. He doesn't want to make decisions and have to execute people and go out hunting and all of these things. And all of his courtiers are raging with him. They're saying, you need to do these things, you're the king. So it's just a really interesting look at, I suppose, what it might have been like to be a monarch at that time. And it's not a very specific book. You don't know exactly who it is or exactly what year it is.
Okay.
But it's very vibesy. It's very atmospheric. It feels like you're there.
I'm sorry to hear you using a term like vibesy,
but
Laura.
But it is vibesy.
Is it split into first half of the book contemporary, second half of the book back in history, or does it get interwoven?
At the very end, we go back to the contemporary time as she comes up with the design. And
don't give away the ending completely.
It's not a big spoiler, but you see what the house looks like in the end after she does her design. So it's sort of sandwiched in the middle, going back in time. And I really enjoyed it. I was just gripped. I read it on a plane journey. I couldn't put it down.
Let's just briefly exit our literary salon and re-enter the real world, where in politics, Angela Rayner and Lucy Powell have now both come out and backed the Prime Minister to keep going. So I think they're both regarded as people who might want to succeed him. So anyway, they've now said, nope, we're right behind you, Keir. So there we go. That's May We Feed the King by Rebecca Perry. It sounds really, really original. I mean, I know you read so many books. Is it just wonderful when you encounter something that genuinely feels fresh and different?
Absolutely. I think because you definitely get trends within fiction, especially particular kinds of stories or kinds of narrators that you see a lot. And then when you have something that is like this, completely different, a sort of job that I probably knew existed but never really thought about.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I just love finding out about people's different jobs, especially if they're ones that you don't normally encounter. I think that's something that fiction can do really well, seeing what someone does day to day, if they're like, I don't know, an art restorer, or in this case, you're designing steely homes. I just find that so fascinating.
It'd be quite funny if Laura had said no. I only like reading all the same old stuff.
Well, sometimes it's what I meant was.
I know what you meant.
I quite enjoy, reading. Should we say novels that follow a pattern? You feel safe in the company of the author because you sort of know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
a body will be discovered on page 11.
But one of your recommendations was exactly that very fresh way of writing, which was The Correspondent.
Oh, did you read it?
I did read it on your recommendation, and actually I gave it to lots of people over Christmas because it's such a brilliant departure from normal prose, because it is all written through emails and letters, but you really have to work hard as the reader, don't you, to keep pinning it all together. But I thought it was great.
Yeah, I particularly liked the way sometimes she sends a letter or receives a letter and you don't know what her reaction is, and you have to try and imagine, oh, is she pleased about what they've said? What's she going to reply? And she might not reply for months, for pages and pages afterwards. So yeah, as you say, you're sort of keeping up with the twists and turns.
Yeah, that's Virginia Evans. Yes.
Correspondent. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Okay, I do have that by my bed. Have yet to explore it. I will do it, I promise. Now, we're going to look at a classic, Dublin, The Dubliners by James Joyce. Now, no, don't underestimate me. I have read this, I think. but what we're here to talk about is the new audiobook version, narrated by a notable actor.
So I sometimes struggle with short stories, I think, because it feels like sometimes by the time you've figured out who all the characters are and what's happening, it's over and then you've got to do it again.
Yeah.
But I got this on Audible and started listening to it, and I just thought it's fantastic. So it's narrated by Andrew Scott.
Hot Priest,
you might remember him as. And what he's really fantastic at in this audio adaptation is all of the accents, because in Dubliners, we meet so many different kinds of people, people from all walks of life, people who are very wealthy and people drunks out in the street. And, you know, and they're not all from Dublin. They're from all over Ireland. You get English characters, and he nails every single accent.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And every character has their own personality. And I just find it a really wonderful way to, because I'd read the book years and years and years ago. And
they're not connected, the short stories, are they?
No, they're not connected. But what I thought was really good is that I tend to listen to audiobooks in the morning when I'm kind of getting ready for work, and I've got a sort of 30-minute...
What about Times Radio's incredibly good breakfast
when
show with Kate McCann and Stig Abel?
When I'm not listening to Times Radio. And I've got sort of 45 minutes. And that, it turns out, is the perfect amount of time for a short story. So you feel like you've kind of experienced the whole story, and then you don't... It's not like you're forgetting what happened the day before, because it's a new story. So,
that's a good tip.
Do you know what? I would love to spend only 24 hours in your head because, Laura, I mean, you read so many books during the week. I am flabbergasted that you choose to listen to a short story on audiobook every day, basically before your brain has woken up. How do you manage to keep a decent kind of wall between each story and each book?
There probably aren't actually that good walls. I don't know. I think sometimes you're reading different things at the same time, and then you realise you've learned something from one particular book, and then you can apply it to the next one, and maybe you find something a bit off about a narrator, and then in the next book they've solved it somehow and that narrator's working in a way that's better. I don't know, they all kind of bleed into one.
It's quite a pace, isn't it? It is quite a pace. How many books do you think you read per week, Garvey?
I can read two, but by reading I mean I kind of go through them in order to be able to discuss them in an interview.
For money.
For money. Okay. How could you have made me say that?
I said it, you didn't say it. I said it, not you.
Yeah. How many can you do the same thing, can't you?
Well, kind of, but I can't, if I'm reading of my own volition, like
that's
holiday
different.
Reading or whatever, I cannot do more than one book a week. And probably one book, I like to, if I'm enjoying it, I like to make it last a good couple of weeks at least. I can't go at a pace.
No, I mean, I do think the audiobook became a sort of revelation to me a couple of years ago, actually when I came to Times Radio, because I can listen on my commute. I just love them so much. So I'm absolutely with you, Laura. Thank you very much for that. That's The Dubliners by James Joyce, out now in audiobook form, narrated by the brilliant Andrew Scott. It's a really good recommendation. Laura, lovely to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Coburn was talking earlier about Ghislaine Maxwell testifying today. She had been hauled before a committee, but apparently she's pleaded the fifth. Wouldn't answer any questions.
Well, that's helpful, isn't it? News back home in our political scrum. Sadiq Khan, London's mayor, has also backed Sir Keir Starmer, but with the addendum, he needs to be given time to deliver. It will be an incredibly busy show for John Pienaar, and he'll have a full roundup of all of the people who have come out this afternoon to back Sir Keir Starmer, and more on the Labour Scottish leader, Anna Sawa, who definitely didn't. Jane and Fee at Times.Radio. We're going to talk money and hopefully give you some tips on how to make the most of yours. That'll be with Adam Shaw. It is 13 minutes to four. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
We will bring you the very latest in this crucial week for the Prime Minister and his survival. Our panel, Kezia Dugdale, our Labour expert, and Alex Chalk, who's been around the block with the Conservatives, will rate the Prime Minister's chances.
Andy Burnham, we're talking about him. He's in Westminster setting out his vision for unsung Britain.
Will there be an ulterior message there as well?
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio. Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
We travel to explore, to learn, to connect. At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Okay, that's six of the ragu and the linguine. Make a move, everyone, please.
The customers are rolling in at Stefano's new restaurant, so he needs another chef. Someone with a cool head and an appetite for success.
More flour in the bechamel, let's go.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Sponsor a job on Indeed to unlock more tools that save you time and help you hire quality candidates. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Adam Shaw is here every Monday to tell you things about money. Sometimes stuff you know, he just makes it clearer. And quite a lot of the time he tells us things that we simply don't know. And this newspaper is doing something with regard to the latter, Adam, isn't it? Because actually, our lack of knowledge about personal finance hinders us throughout our lives. It is such an important thing to know about, but it hasn't been taught in schools, and you have to go and find it yourself. Dot, dot, dot.
Yes, and so the Times is running a campaign to improve that education in schools and elsewhere. And I think, if one put aside the mechanics of how we make that happen for just one moment, I think it is really important, because often the richest people, I think, are not just those who've earned the most, but who do the most with the money they have. And it's very undemocratic, therefore, in this sense that those who have knowledge are given more knowledge and more wealth. And it's an easier fix. It's a complex world. And I think this has come to the fore most recently with the Plan 2 student loans. And you think about that. That's a financial product which is going to be with someone for their entire life. There isn't another financial product that I can think of which someone will be with for that length of time. And that is effectively sold to students without any advice at all. There is not another product I can think of where that would be legal, even, let alone recommended. And yet we're sending these kids into a lifelong world of debt with no advice. Mm. And obviously armed with information gives you the ability to make your own assessments of whether that and the whole range of financial products throughout your life would be worth it.
So there are government plans, aren't there, to put some kind of personal personal finance education into the curriculum. But actually, the Times wants to go further and is calling for ministers to guarantee to provide 15 hours of money lessons a year for secondary school pupils and to also offer this to all over 16s. The curriculum should include lessons on the power of investing in the stock market. So that's all well and good, but it's also just very simple things, isn't it? Like understanding compound interest, something which I don't think I did until I was in my 30s.
Yeah, you probably do it in maths, but it's taken out of context. And I think there is a sense of some facts, like what the stock market has often done in the past. But I think even more valuable than perhaps some facts is the ability to understand things, because the products will change over your lifetime. And I think the big thing that I've noticed with people of all ages is that they're embarrassed to ask questions. It's complicated. They don't want to appear foolish and therefore back off asking. And I think giving them the confidence to ask questions actually would be the most important skill, to feel confident with the language, to feel confident with the tools, and therefore to feel confident when you're faced with someone who's trying to sell you something, which, when these financial companies sell you stuff, they talk about, oh, it's just 1%. It's really 1% doesn't sound a lot, like in pension costs. This can be really significant over long periods of time. And to understand that, I think, would be really empowering for people.
Well, we definitely back that call, don't we, Jane? Because yeah, I think it's incredibly important, especially for women. We invest less than men. And, you know, it'd be so helpful for so many women for that not to be the case, because often, you know, we are missing large chunks of our salary due to maternity leave and childcare and stuff like that.
Yeah.
No. I'm always saying this, but I just don't understand why you lose out on your national insurance when you're at home having given birth to somebody who's likely to pay tax.
Yes.
I just don't understand it. Why do you not get something for that?
I mean, it's not my policy.
I'm just angry.
You please feel free to vent your anger towards me. But I think it's those sorts of questions. If one feels empowered about understanding the issues in front of you, I think it's easier for women, but lots of other types of people and groups and whatever, to raise the issues of concern to them. They will feel empowered. So it is a big issue. And it's so important to your overall well-being, this issue, that it is a bit odd that we just go, well, we're going to teach you a bit of geography, but throw you out into a world where people will try and sell you stuff unarmed. And arming you properly, I think, is a jolly good idea.
Yeah, but there's no point knowing all about peninsulas if you can't afford to get to one. Let's talk about assets with attitude. From vroom to vintage, we're looking at the glam and distinctly risky side of alternative investments, it says here. Adam, get risky with us.
Okay. Sorry. You wrong-footed me with all of that. Yes. Talking about
what
risky.
What are we talking about here?
Yeah, okay. We're talking about risky. I think it's interesting given where we are. So there's been this massive rally in lots of assets. But now, and we talked on this program, something of a collapse in lots of different things, in Bitcoin, in gold, in some stock markets, especially the tech as well. And I think enter stage, right, therefore, a sort of another idea of investing in luxury assets, really for the rich and famous often. There is an index, the Knight Frank Investment Luxury Investment Index, which tracks what happens here. And it is sort of interesting from a political point of view. Most of the wealth in the world lies in America, and therefore what Americans think is quite important. But over the long term, I think we're seeing huge rise in Africa, an African middle class emerging. I did a TV documentary recently about the rising power of young people in China, and what they want will determine what the world actually makes. So there's a sort of interesting change going on here. Luxury products, even though there's huge amounts of very, very crazy rich people, the luxury product index actually fell about 3%. But over the long term, that's in the past year, but over the long term, it tends to do rather well, not quite as well as the FTSE recently. But for instance, if you'd invested $1 million in 2005 in the luxury index, it would now be worth £5.4 million. That you can go through lots of issues here, and I'm very happy to do that with you. One thing I should say is, even if it's exciting and fun to do this, it's an illiquid market. So if you buy a share, it's quite easy to sell it. If you buy a classic car or a fine wine Bordeaux, it's not so easy to sell, and the pricing isn't as easy to get hold of. So there are huge amounts of risk. It's only for those with money to lose, I would say, and a bit of fun.
And also, it's a very... It's a thing that comes with practical difficulties, isn't it? I mean, if you've got a share, you don't have to find a garage to put it in or have an extra bit of security on your house.
Yes.
All that type of stuff.
Yeah. So wine is the classic example. People investing in fine wines. The upside of that, you go, well, look, the fine wine rose in value. That's great. If it fell in value, I'll drink it, and it's quite a nice wine. So it's sort of a win-win is the idea. But that's certainly a more expensive wine than I would ever drink or afford to drink when you're investing in
those. And if it goes up in value, what do? Flog it?
You flog it. And there are markets which will do that for you. And there are funds where you can buy into a wine fund like you can buy into a share fund. But exactly to your point, Fee, you can't put the wine next to the boiler in your house. It needs to be stored properly because these are really expensive bottles of wine. So effectively, you're not having it yourself. So there's a cost of storage as well, Keir, and a cost of what you're buying, because a Marks & Spencer share, for instance, is a Marks & Spencer share. One Bordeaux is not like another Bordeaux. So you've got to know what you're doing as well.
The one part of the market that I've always been flabbergasted by is the luxury handbag market, because... You know, sometimes you'll see, I think the Birkin bags in particular go for hundreds of thousands of pounds. But who's buying them? Because they aren't using them, are they? The handbag depreciates as soon as you
I don't know. I think the Jane... I mean, I agree with you. I think the handbag market's really interesting. The Jane Birkin bag was named after Jane Birkin, who wanted, I think, a bigger bag to chuck lots of stuff in so she could carry it around, and was sat next to a designer on an aeroplane, said, there are no decent women's handbags. I want one which is actually functioning. He went out and designed one. Of course, they're so expensive... No one in their right mind would actually wander around with lots of stuff in it and go to Tesco and chuck the oranges in there. And you can't get them. And this is, it typifies, you know, it's the best and worst of the luxury market. I don't think you can go in and buy a Jane Birkin bag or a lot of these other ones, however much money you've got. They want to say, well, you've got to buy something else first and you've got to go on a waiting list. And that idea of not being able to get it is the value. So if you see someone with one, you go, you know that's expensive, you know that's someone who leads a luxury lifestyle. But I think actually the handbag market has done quite well. But, you know, I was looking at British Vogue, their guide to them. The Gucci Jackie handbag, apparently a true icon. I don't know, is that well known?
Don't look at us, we're not really...
Okay, I thought you just might have some more expertise. It'll cost you about £3,000. The future heirloom, they say, if you're interested in buying these things, the Rose Margot, about £4,000. I think you can find a Birkin on eBay at £16,500. But one was sold recently, not a Birkin, but a Hermes for £330,000.
Well, that's just stupid. That's even more expensive than a Waitrose bag for life, Adam.
Yeah,
I can't take
it.
Thank you very much. You can find out all of the details of what Adam's been talking about at Adam Shaw Biz.
Yes, and the books that we mentioned earlier, I've written them down here for you, Caroline. I'm going to squeeze them in. A Private Man and May We Feed the King.
Look across the UK on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. I'm John Pina, here with Times Radio Drive at 4 o'clock. And here are the headlines. The leader of Scottish Labour has become the most senior figure in the party to call on Sir Keir Starmer to resign. And meanwhile, Cabinet Ministers have been rallying behind the Prime Minister, tweeting their support. Coming up, we're going to be talking to the Welsh Secretary, Joe Stevens, and Keir Starmer's former Director of Communications, James Lyons. Big question, if and when the Prime Minister decides to call it quits, well, when does that happen? Stay with us.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Stuart Winnie.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. Angela Rayner and Wes Streeting have both backed Sir Keir Starmer as ministers rally round in a coordinated show of support. The two likely leadership contenders spoke out after the leader of Scottish Labour called on the Prime Minister to quit. Anna Sawa said the Prime Minister is a decent man, but the people of Scotland are crying out for competent government.
The distraction needs to end and the leadership in Downing Street has to change. I have to be honest about failure wherever I see it. The situation in Downing Street is not good enough. There have been too many mistakes. They promised they were going to be different, but too much has happened.
Meanwhile, multiple sources have told The Times the Labour First Minister in Wales, Eluned Morgan, has the same view as Sawa on the Prime Minister's future. But a Downing Street spokesman insists Sir Keir Starmer has a clear five-year mandate from the British people and will stay the course. The Prime Minister will address Labour MPs this evening, including Carl Turner, who hit out at Anna Sawa's intervention, telling Times Radio it would be balmy to change leader now.
I think Keir Starmer is unpopular in the country and the Labour government are unpopular in the country, and I think Annis has bottled it and decided to call for the PM to go on the basis that it might improve Scottish Labour's chances of forming a government there. But I think it's a mistake. I think it's unfair. And frankly, I think it's disloyal.
Elsewhere, police are looking into claims that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor exploited his work as trade envoy for the government by passing information to Jeffrey Epstein. Thames Valley Police say they're assessing information that appears to show he shared confidential files in emails released by the US Department of Justice. Meanwhile, the King has again been heckled over Andrew's links to Epstein as the Prince and Princess of Wales make their first public statement on the issue, saying they're deeply concerned. The Sunday Times Royal Editor, Roya Nicker, is travelling with Prince William to Saudi Arabia.
The idea that a member of the royal family would do that is extraordinary. I know we're all still reeling from knowing that what has come out in the files suggesting that Poutal Man wasn't done that, but the fact that it is suggested that the late Queen's son on official business was forwarding that to Epstein is a pretty extraordinary allegation.
Ghislaine Maxwell has declined to answer questions from lawmakers in the United States. The former partner of Jeffrey Epstein cited her right not to incriminate herself. Police are being investigated for alleged gross misconduct over the handling of the response to a paedophile operating at a summer camp. 76-year-old John Rubin, who used sweets to drug children and sexually assault them, was jailed on Friday. And more than 100 areas in England face flooding as forecasters warn downpours are set to continue. A yellow weather warning for rain is in place for southwest England and South Wales until midnight. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
It is good to have you with us here on Drive on Times Radio. I'm John Pienaar, and I've got a lot to talk about on the show today. A lot of guests are going to throw a lot of light, I hope, on what at the moment is a story with so many unknowns, so many dark corners still to be illuminated. Cabinet ministers now, they are literally queuing up to pay tributes and pledge support for the Prime Minister. And if you need evidence that time is up for Keir Starmer, well, that'll do. How does Starmer keep going? Why has he not resigned? It's not a rhetorical question. Larry the Downing Street cat hasn't resigned yet. Well, last time I looked. So maybe there's still hope for Keir Starmer. I don't think so, to be frank. But I'm starting to believe that Starmer may actually believe it's worth fighting on. Despite losing his chief aide and political mentor, Morgan McSweeney, his top media advisor, having now been thrown under the bus by Labour's leader in Scotland. And after losing the faith of many, maybe most Labour MPs and certainly most voters. Well, the answer to the question, how does he keep going, surely lies in his own state of mind. So what might tip the balance and tip Starmer over the edge, make him resign? It is a cruel question. No one suggests that Starmer is other than a perfectly decent man who wants the best for the country and his party. And if, rather than when he goes, it won't in truth simply be because of his disastrous decision to appoint Keir Starmer as Peter Mandelson as American ambassador, even though he knew Mandelson had a friendly relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. That was just the last straw, the tipping point for MPs who'd already decided their leader had close to zero political ability and nous and that they needed a new one. Well, could this meeting this evening with Labour MPs at Westminster tip the balance? Well, conceivably, though these private gatherings are anything but private. They're choreographed exercises in spin. Still, if there's a mutiny, it could mark the end. We'll see, and we'll be watching for you, and we will bring you the latest on that. And meanwhile, ambitious potential leaders in the cabinet are outside and outside are on manoeuvres. They're planning, they're plotting, they're drumming up support for a future leadership contest. Some of them are duly declaring undying support for the Prime Minister at the same time. And I'll have the latest on that for you too. Now, even before the Mandelson scandal erupted, it seemed a question of not if, but when Starmer would go. Now, it's a question of whether it'll be soon or even sooner. And the answer to that is, who knows? Does even Starmer have a clue? Tell me what you're thinking. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to at
Times Radio. Now, let's just start our look at what has been going on and still is going on today by catching up. Manasawa, you may have heard it on Times Radio. He's now the most senior figure in the party to call on the PM to quit. Some was under such pressure over Peter Mandelson's appointment as the UK ambassador to America. And at this news conference a little while ago, the leader of Scottish Labour said the people of Scotland were crying out for competent government.
This isn't easy, and it's not without pain, as I have a genuine friendship with Keir Starmer. But my first priority and my first loyalty is to my country, Scotland. And I am not willing to sacrifice Scotland's NHS, our schools, our communities, our towns, cities, villages and islands to a third decade of an SNP government. That's why the distraction needs to end and the leadership in Downing Street has to change.
Well, Manasawa went on to say that although his call for Keir Starmer to resign caused him personal hurt and pain, Scotland was his first priority. And meanwhile, the Science Secretary, Liz Kendall, was asked if she believed Keir Starmer could survive.
He can and he should, because I think I remember only too well, Beth, one of the reasons why the country elected us was because they were sick of all the changes in leadership under the Conservatives. And I think it would be wrong after barely 18 months after our election for people to think that they can just change the leader and everything will go right. I think that is not the right approach.
The Science Secretary, Liz Kendall, there. Let's touch in now with Anna Mikhailova, our political editor at Times Radio. Hello to you, Anna.
Hi, John.
Hi. Do you want to get us up to date with how it looks where you are? We've been seeing these pledges of loyalty to the Prime Minister from senior ministers, a good number of them, and you're hearing talk of possible ministerial resignations. Just make sense of this for us.
No, so just to clarify, it's been a very dramatic day, obviously in the morning.